Manuel Buttigieg u lijem għawċi jilqaw l-ismija ta' Campus 103.7 għall-arbohra edin maħna għal-taħdita klio. Il-lum għanna maħna palamistinna l-professur Anna Kaki li hija Associate Professor fil-Departiment tal-Studji Internazzjonali fiħdan il-Fakulta tal-Arti tal-Università ta' Malta. U dan l-episodju partikolari ser ikun bl-Ingliż. Anna, a warm welcome to you. It's a real pleasure to have you. We've been hunting you for a while to get you here, but like all good things, you have to be perseverant. So it's wonderful to have you with us. And yes, she does know a bit of Maltese, I should say that. Anna, perhaps you could start, if you could give us a little sketch of who you are for our listeners. You come from Sweden, but you've been in Malta for a long time now. You're practically Maltese as well. So, and your field of international studies, how you came to it?
Well, I think I was always interested in international politics. So I'm Swedish. I studied for my master's and my PhD in Switzerland. I worked there for a while. I also had the occasion to live during my studies in France and in Hungary. And then eventually life took me to Malta. So I've lived in various different countries and seen various different types of political systems for that matter. But I think that international relations was always in my blood because I could see directly how both my families, both on my father's and my mother's side, were directly impacted by history and the vagaries of historical events. So I think that brought me to this discipline.
Very good. And we're saying that you come from international politics, so you're interested in the now, mm-hmm. you know, what is happening now. But how much do you go back if you want to make sense of the now? So how does your discipline relate to ours, history, you know? And we like to think of IR as one of our daughter disciplines, you know, like archaeology and all the others. But yeah, how does this daughter function?
Well, I think that we do rely a lot on history. Obviously, there are different branches of international relations, but I would say that European international relations is very anchored on an understanding of history, because you cannot understand the present without having a good understanding of the past. We cannot understand what's happening in Gaza today without understanding the history of Palestine going back at least a century, but also looking at the history of Europe going back just as far back in time. But there are also other ways in which international relations make use of history beyond this very obvious thing that we need to understand the past, to understand the present. There's also a lot of discussions around historical analogies and how that affects how politicians think and act. So the most famous example is probably the Munich analogy. So basically that is obviously harking back at the Munich conference in 1938 and the fact that France and the United Kingdom agreed to give the Sudetenland to Nazi Germany at the time, and it was a way of preserving peace. So appeasement, as it later became known. And obviously that led to eventually the Second World War, or it did not at least prevent the Second World War from happening. And this Munich analogy has been used time and again, in the last instance is when we're looking at Europe today. So politicians are using the Munich analogy and saying, are we facing the same situation when we're looking at the Russia-Ukraine equation? So they're saying, is this a revisionist power that wants to profoundly reshape the European order?
Anna, mm-hmm. I would like only to spend 30 seconds about what happened in Munich. Mm-hmm. In 1938, so that our listeners can understand and correct me if I'm wrong. So you had Nazi Germany claiming that the Sudetenland, one of the most industrial parts of Czechoslovakia, where today the car Skoda was being produced, were claiming that there are Germans there, that they are being persecuted, and Nazi Germany wanted to capture that by force, but England and France, especially Chamberlain from the English side, wanted to try and make peace or give the Sudetenland to Nazi Germany to avoid war. But obviously Czechoslovakia, as how it was known back then, fell within months to Germany. Is that a good quick analogy?
Yeah. Perfect. Okay. So there had been prior acts of appeasement. They had agree to the Anschluss, so the Austrian.
Of the Austrian.
Yeah, so this was yet
the
another.
Ruhr Valley and yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's we're talking about politics where we're trying to avoid war by giving the strong man his little prize.
Yes, but then the idea is that we have to avoid a repeat of that. So the idea, I think, what politicians would be saying today is that we cannot repeat Munich. And if this is like Munich, then we have to act accordingly. So we have to rearm, we have to refocus our alliances, we have to even refocus our supply chains and how we arrange our economic relations.
So this is what, in your opinion, this is the Ukraine situation.
Yeah, exactly. So this is the analogy, the historical analogy that they're using to understand the present. So everything hinges on whether Putin and Russia today are revisionist in the same way that Germany was revisionist in the 1930s. So that's the force of historical analogies.
Yes. And of course, there's a very sobering message there, no? How far do you go in appeasing, but still end up with a war?
Yeah.
Or do you take the stand and risk war as well?
Exactly.
It's not an easy one to call, no? If you're the one who has to take the decision effectively.
Yes. And now we're in a very delicate international position. Situation generally, we're seeing a change in the international economic order potentially and also the security order. And again, politicians are thinking, is this like the 1930s? Mm. Are we seeing a breakdown in international collaboration and international trade? The beginnings of maybe another recession? Are we seeing the rise of authoritarian powers? Or is this more similar to the 1950s and 60s and the Cold War? And we're seeing a competition between liberal democracy and authoritarian rule. And again, which analogy they choose to draw on will have different implications for action.
Of course. And again, the 30s are interesting because it was a moment when the US was erratic, was isolationist, and you needed a change, an election and a change in the presidency to eventually bring them to Europe's help and assist in what was happening. So here's to hoping. another area that you're interested in is when it comes to history in textbooks, curricula, schools. You know, what are children learning? And therefore, what impact is that having on, these children as they grow up, but also how the decision makers are getting involved in what is being taught and these children become decision makers themselves. How come you're interested in that particular angle as well?
Well, I must say I haven't been researching that specifically. It's something that has been done more by others. But it's fascinating what is said and what is not said about history and how that changes over time. So I have now a lot of conversations with people of my generation who studied history in Europe in 30 years ago. And they said we never spoke about colonialism, for instance. So this would be the French, the British and others. And now that is changing. Uh-huh. So people are starting to reassess what is important in history and what is not important. So it's as much about what is being studied as what is not being studied.
The leaders of the future are being taught history today.
Yeah.
And to hark back to the Ukrainian situation, we have a case where around 20,000 children, Ukrainian children, have been captured by the Russians and are being taught a new version of history, as dictated by let's say, the worldview of Mr. Putin.
Yes, when we talk about power in IR, when I teach beginner students, if you will, we talk about military power, we talk about economic power, we talk about power in terms of the size of the country, but we also talk about ideological power. And part of ideological power is obviously history as well, culture, how you interpret it. What is our culture? What is our history?
Yes, and this whole issue of colonialism is interesting because of all the passions that it still generates. I mean, if you go to France, the way they look at the Algerian War, for example, you know, into the 1950s, 60s, my impression is that actually quite a lot of people are not really aware of it. And when it comes up, it's always a huge, you know, flare of passions rather than some kind of rational discussion. And it happens in other places as well. I mean, even Belgium, not such a small country, yeah, but with quite a dark history to, yes, it, when it comes to the course. Congo. And
King Leopold.
Yeah.
Yes. Uh-huh. No, definitely. I mean, they're always saying President Macron was the first president to be born after the end of the War of Independence of Algeria. And actually, already when he was campaigning back in when he became president for the first term, he said that we have to reassess our historical relationship to Algeria. And he actually went on to appoint a historian, Stora, to lead a whole historical work. So a set of historians working on reassessing and opening archives when it comes to the Algerian case. He's done the same when it comes to Rwanda. Obviously, Rwanda was a Belgian colony, but its post-colonial relationship, funnily, was more with France than with Belgium. And so in the there again, France had a very difficult situation and a very difficult past to get over when it came to the Rwandan genocide. There again, President Macron appointed a historical team to look at that. He's also looked at West African countries in the same light. And often what is also interesting is that this has been historians both from the colony concerned or the former colony concerned and French historians working together at creating a historical narrative.
And you see that different countries look towards colonialism in a different way. It's also France has a way of looking at it. England and Great Britain obviously have a way at looking at it, even Italy. Do you see these differences?
Yes, it's both interesting to see the differences and the similarities.
The similarities, yes.
Because we can say that at the time we're at this juncture, it seems to me, in history, where this is coming to the fore. So in France, it's very, very, there's that strong work being done, but at the same time, it's very, very sensitive. And there's this kind of rejection of this kind of discussion about the past. We see the same in the Netherlands, we see the same in Belgium that was mentioned, the same in the UK. There has been a lot of more discussions regarding the role of the United Kingdom in the transatlantic slave trade. And that's something where some Commonwealth nations have been saying, look, we have to reassess this and there has to be a discussion around compensation. Keir Starmer was saying it was horrendous. It's something that shouldn't have happened, but the compensation question is out of the question.
I think when it comes to slavery, I honestly get really confused when it comes to how are we going to look at it, because even the kind of slavery was different. So you're talking about Caribbean slavery, transatlantic slavery, then you have slavery in the Indian subcontinent, where you actually have the locals who were not under British rule doing, you know, slavery, having slavery as an instituted situation, where they used to travel to Ethiopia to capture tribes which were on the margins of Ethiopian society, send them to India and turn them into slaves. Some of them became leaders as well, and you start seeing how the world is looking at them. And one last thing about this is obviously, for me, I love to call him, because the title of a very good book, The Black Spartacus, when it comes to Haiti, and Saint-Domingue. A few weeks ago, I got to know that even the English did atrocities against the Haitians when they were fighting against the French. You start seeing, I think, is the world ready to do all these apologies, or is the world ready to reinterpret history?
Or forget it.
Sorry, that was a very long-winded question.
Yes, yes. And it's a very complicated topic, so has to be any question, and let alone any answer, will be long-winded on this. And obviously, Slavery is an age-old tradition, so which has now been more or less, though not fully, eradicated. So it's actually a sign of human progress, which is something to celebrate probably today when we don't seem to see very many signs of human progress. So, but when we look at the transatlantic slave trade, it was very commodified, meaning that they were really bought and sold and slavery was inherited and it was very racialized vis-a-vis black people. When we look at slavery in the context of the Mediterranean, it's quite different. Yeah.
Yes, totally different.
So it created a different set of dynamics, both within African societies and within the societies in the Caribbean, in North and South America. The slave trading issue is complex. I think the British are really starting to talk about it a lot more. What's interesting is to see what's happening in the US, where we're seeing that this kind of discussion around first slavery and then the segregation in the South is being more obfuscated. We're seeing that titles are being removed from libraries, that it's being removed from the curricula of schools, etc. So it's part of that difficult reckoning with the past.
Yes, an attempt to distill history, I think, is sometimes a bit dangerous, but it's happening.
I think there's a very human tendency to want to remember and find very relevant the glorious aspects of our past, however far away in history. But those are never
It happens with our personal memories. I want to remember the good times.
Yes, and the times when you felt that you did really well and that you were right. But those times when that wasn't really the case, we tend to want to say it's not really important. And I think that's very true also. At the
How much do all of these things then filter into, let's say, when the European Union is having discussions with African nations for free trade areas? Is that baggage brought into the room by both sides, by one side only, or do they leave the suitcase outside because they think, oh, well, current monetary concerns should trump everything? What do you see from your perspective?
Well, this is something I've been interested in, EU relations with the rest of the world for a long time, particularly with the Southern Mediterranean, but also beyond. And if we look at both trade agreement. So each trade agreement or cooperation agreement that the EU signs has a common clause, which is about that it's conditional, the agreement is conditional on the respect for human rights and democracy. European Union officials often also make pronouncements on the respect or non-respect rather for democracy and human rights in different countries around the world. And there is also what is called democracy assistance, which is a set of projects and programs which are designed to support human rights and democracy in countries outside of the EU. So that could be support for the legal sector, support for media, support for civil society organizations, support for parliament, etc., on human rights and democracy. What's interesting here, and to come back to your question, is that when they're undertaking all these kinds of activities, which are often called democracy support or democracy promotion or whatever, they tend to rely on a very selective reading at the end of the day of European history. So on the one hand, if we look at the European project, it's a very historically anchored project because it's based on overcoming the massive killing within Europe. So all the two world wars, the different authoritarian and totalitarian projects in Europe that have led to the loss of millions and millions of lives over the centuries. So they're saying, look, after having fought between ourselves for all these centuries, we're now at peace because of the EU. And it's because we are espousing these values of human rights and democracy. So that's an interesting and hopeful reading of history. But what at the same time, and it's a beautiful reading of history, when the EU got the Nobel Peace Prize, this is something that was remembered, and beautiful anecdotes were told about that overcoming of the animosity, the deep-seated animosity between Germany and France. But on the other hand, what is not part of this history is this other side of pre-EU history, which is colonization and all the atrocities that European countries committed outside of Europe rather than inside of Europe. And that becomes very tricky then when the European Union is promoting democracy and human rights elsewhere while not talking at all about what has been done in Europe's name before.
Sure. It's mm-hmm. a very fine line. No?
It's mm-hmm. an extremely fine line.
That needs to be tread there. Which is why some historical education is important, no? Because mm-hmm. it otherwise, well, how do you know how to avoid or not these kinds of pitfalls? It's the world of the diplomats then, no?
Yes. And that's where sometimes there is this kind of, how should I say, artificial boundary and sometimes a little bit of friendly animosity between historians and IR scholars, but I would be the first one to champion history. So I'm on your side, by the way.
Of course.
as you should, as you should. In current politics and international relations, do you see that world leaders want to know what actually happened? Or do they want to have their own, and I'm going to use a bit of an ugly word, their perverted views on world history? Do you see it out there? Do you see that this decision by Trump to turn Gaza into the Riviera and into a Riviera in the Middle East is being done because he's got an insight in history, or because he has no clue of what history is?
Well, obviously, it's an impossible question to answer.
I know.
Because it will so much
I'm known for that kind of question.
Because it depends on the historical leader. But it's also, if we go back to, for example, Macron, the French
yes.
president, he is, again, that fine line that he's treading, which is that on the one hand, he's trying to sort of open up historical research on the very most sensitive aspects of the colonial past. On the one hand, he will say, he will actually apologize for specific instances of that past, but not for an overall French colonial history in Algeria. That's
and they cannot
sensitive.
Do it. I think no.
He's
leader.
He's famous for, I forget the French term for it now. He'll say yes, uh-huh. mm-hmm. but on the other hand,
yes, uh-huh, yes.
There's a particular term for it, which is Kiesel.
The the Germans admitted, obviously, the genocide against the Jewish people during the
yes.
Holocaust, but it took them much longer to admit to the genocide that they committed long before in the
first
Namibia.
Yeah. Sorry. Yes, of course. Yes.
And that was also related to this issue of reparations again. So similar to Starmer saying, okay, if we issue an apology and if we take on historical responsibility for this genocide, we also need to pay reparations. That becomes very tricky, and that's also something that makes historical remembrance more complicated.
Yeah. So in fact, there are initiatives, but they tend to be private initiatives, no, where someone has recognized that their family is rich today because
yes.
they were slave traders. So you try and institute, I don't know, scholarships that help people from Jamaica to get a university education. No, this sort of initiatives. But yeah, I can see why a state
will not
difficult to
yeah, but we have the institutions in between. So we have universities, for example, in the UK that are increasingly looking at their endowments and where they came from and saying, look, we see that this endowment historically is related to the trade in enslaved people, and therefore they will also do similar kinds of arrangements to try to mm-hmm. atone, if you will, for that. Yeah. So it's happening as well.
I think the best example is Clive of India with his statue in front of Parliament in the UK, who was somebody who actually conquered the whole of India for the East India Company and not for Great Britain. So this was a private initiative.
Yes.
But I want to also, maybe sometimes you also start to see in the new narrative of history, where, for example, the role of colonial troops in the Second World War, which helped obviously the Allies defeat the Axis powers, mm-hmm. and maybe it's a soft way of integrating the colonies into the new narrative of history. So
even that creates rejection sometimes. Mm-hmm. We're used to a picture of the Second World War, which is very white.
Yes.
Yes.
Suddenly, you start seeing Indians and Africans and Maltese.
And Maltese, yes, yes. Yeah.
And we're like,
yes.
What's going on there, no?
Mm-hmm. And that points us to another part of history, which is not linked directly to politics, but which has a big effect on political groups is the cultural productions. So we're used to all these movies which show us a very white Second World War, a very white First World War, when in fact, in reality, they were anything but. Uh-huh.
And we should not forget, though, that there were dark episodes as well. I mean, in Italy, when the French were brought in, all these Moroccan troops, for example, yes. mm. who committed some really horrible acts, or mm-hmm. rapes in particular. Mm-hmm. So as everywhere, as every other issue, it's not just a case of black and white. No, there's different shades and we need to acknowledge all of them. Unfortunately, yeah. they tend to focus more on the bad stuff. In that case, it soothes the narrative, no? Mm-hmm. As against the positives that there were.
This brings in also the colonial collaborators. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, enslaved Africans being sent to the Caribbean were enslaved, or sometimes by their own kin,
yeah.
and sent to the Caribbean. And I love the idea of some of the great heroes of every nation, such as Napoleon, such as Nelson himself. At the end of the day, they have their dark spot because they both supported slavery. It's something that maybe even in our narrative of the 20th century, these things were not being discussed.
Yes.
We're running out of time. I just realized that we're running out of time. And it was a great program. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
And please, thank you once again for accepting our invitation. On my behalf and Emmanuel Buttigieg's behalf, we are ending our program here, and we look forward to having you back on our program.
A little less harder to catch.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really a pleasure and an honor.
It was. Thank you. Dear listeners, thank you for being with us. We'll catch you next week.